Hi, my name is Dan Mason, and I program radio stations that you've probably never listened to. But you're listening to the Handsome Timmy D Express, and that's what matters.
Well, hello, dear reader, hello, dear listener, and welcome to episode 34 of the Handsome Timmy D Express, which, as you know, or maybe you don't, is a proud part of the Dan and Travis Show, an awesome podcast about awesome things that you can find over on iTunes or your podcast apps, or you can just Google Dan and Travis. We're also a proud part of The Chronic Rift, which is a series of podcasts that attempt to find the culture in pop culture. This and just a ton of other great podcasts ranging from movie reviews to explorations of zombies and Batman and all kinds of great stuff. It can be found over at www.chronicrift.com. I want to thank everybody for listening, tweeting, downloading. Traffic has just been phenomenal over the past months, which is great considering I snuck a move across LA in there. So thanks everybody for the continued support. I'm glad everybody is enjoying the show, especially last week's episode with Simon Guerriere about the scientific secrets of Doctor Who. And then I'm proud to welcome today a fellow who's got, as usual with a lot of my guests, he's a fellow that wears a lot of different hats and has been working hard to sort of take control of his career. And I think we have an interesting topic this week in talking about how, in many ways, in the entertainment business and in the creative life, you are actually more master of your own destiny than you realize. Gregor Collins is an actor, producer, writer. He wrote a memoir years ago that's just fascinating about his relation. Well, I'll let him get more into it, but it's called The Accidental Caregiver, which was a memoir that he later turned into a stage play. So he's had a quite interesting creative journey. So welcome to the Handsome Timmy D Express, Gregor Collins.
Thank you, sir. Good to be here.
So The Accidental Caregiver, how did this come about?
Well, in 2008, I was living in – I just moved to New York. I was in L.A. for 15 years, and so – came to LA around 2000 and got into the reality TV world. Was sort of a freelance reality TV producer for about 4 or 5 years, and then I decided to be an actor, and I found that to be something I was good at that I didn't realize that good at, and then did that for a little bit and got into the indie film world and got a couple of films off the ground, and then I met. In 2008, I met a Holocaust survivor, and everything changed, pretty much.
Now, how, like, you describe it in the synopsis here, a chance meeting with, I'm going to say this right, Maria Altman?
Yes, yes.
Who's a Holocaust survivor. It's in the political world and the political discourse these days, the word Nazi and what Nazi Germany did is thrown around really quite freely in a way that I think is I don't mind saying, a bit repugnant, because I don't think a lot of us today truly understand what the Nazis did and what people like this friend of yours went through.
Right.
So how did you guys come to meet, and what was it that inspired you to write this memoir?
Well, I say chance because it was really a random thing. I'm acting at the time. My friend Tom calls me up and he says, Gregor, I met this lady on Craigslist. There was an ad to be a caregiver, and she's from Europe. She was a Holocaust survivor, has an incredible story, and I'm taking care of her. I'm living in her house, and I'm taking care of her. You should come by the house, and you should meet her one day. And I sort of blew him off for a while. He would kind of text me and call me and about this lady, and I would blow him off, and I'm an actor. I'm busy. I don't really have time for old ladies at the moment. But he finally called me and said they need another caregiver. There had been about three caregivers, or there had been two caregivers, him and somebody else. They left suddenly, and suddenly they were in need of a caregiver, because at this time Maria was just about to turn 92, and she needed kind of around the clock care. So I kind of begrudgingly, I felt like I needed to do him a favor and at least go meet her. I said, I'll meet her, but I didn't want to commit to anything. And so I went to her house in Cheviot Hills, which is sort of southern Beverly Hills. I met her, and it was like we had met in another life. It was it was like a love at first sentence, I describe it as. She opened up her mouth, and she had this wonderful old world accent that you don't that you don't hear anymore. And it was just like, we had so much to talk about. And it was like, I was 32 at the time and she was 92. And so that's sort of like now, I mean, 7 years later, I'm still talking about this woman. So
it sounds like a real kindred spirit.
Oh, absolutely. We were kindred spirits, and she was so much to me. She became so quickly so much to me. One day, I mean, she had such a sense of humor too. I mean, one day I said, Maria, you're like a mother, a grandmother, and a friend to me. And she said, well, what about mistress? You know, so she had this unbelievable, kind of a naughty sense of humor in her 90s. And she still had this joie de vivre and this sort of sensuality in her 90s.
Well, I then she probably wouldn't mind me making the joke that a story that begins with a friend told me about this lady on Craigslist doesn't really end with, you know, a 92-year-old Holocaust survivor.
And it still baffles me today. I think, man, and she comes, you know, and you can Google her as well. But she comes from one of the wealthiest, most influential families in Austria at the turn of the 20th century. And so here, a woman of this ilk is on a website where you can find, like, someone to, you know, have fun with for a night, you know, and then right next to that is a caregiver ad. So it's just like, it baffles me that she was on that site. But
so you talked to me about like this experience, and it's kind of eye opening. What was it, or was it the eye opening learning from this woman that made you put pen to paper and say, I need to keep track, I need to make a memoir of this? Or was it something like somebody needs to tell her story?
Well, it was both. Partly the non-emotional kind of part of it was I kind of felt like I owed it to history a little bit, because she had these anecdotes that you can't Google and you couldn't find really in history books. Some of the things that she was telling me, and these just incredible little anecdotes about figures and these amazing, I mean, her aunt Adele, who's in the gold portrait, she would host a salon with all the most prominent intellectuals and artists of the day. And so she would have all these little stories about these famous people. And so that part of it, I felt like I need to at least be writing this down because it would be lost to history. And then, but most of it was I was really falling in love with this woman. And it was like my eyes were, I was being opened up to this whole new world of art and culture. And I was, you know, the rub was I was thinking, wait a second, I don't belong here. I need to be acting. This isn't part of the plan. I wasn't supposed to be caring for an old lady, but yet I was falling in love with her. And I was like, this is the most incredible woman I've ever met. And so I felt like I need to be writing this kind of struggle down. And so like every chapter became sort of like a day in the life of, and where I would reach my own enlightenment. And I would also be telling stories of the Holocaust. It was like this incredibly emotional journey for me.
Yeah. It sounds, it's almost hard to define, you know what I mean? Like, it's like I'm picturing this and it's almost like a grandmother, grandson type thing, but, or just a mentor student, but it sounds like that's not really doing it justice. That's not really accurate.
It's not. And that's why I say when I'm, because I'm talking about the play or the film and continuing to tell the story, that's why I kind of say it's somewhere in between Harold and Maude and, Tuesdays with Maury. So there was, because Tuesdays with Maury, it's two guys, you know, and it's like where we had this male-female dynamic, and it was like we looked at each other, and she would say, I wish we met 70 years ago, you know, and I really felt that in my bones. And I mean, this woman was at the sunset of her life, and so she had more of a comfort level with things, saying things, whereas me, it would just really hit me a lot harder.
So you released the memoir. Now there's also the, like, hopefully this question doesn't upset you, but a lot of times in the world of writing, whether it be a memoir, fiction or nonfiction, there's always a fear of what other people are going to think. Mm-hmm. And like, oh my God, is somebody going to think I'm crazy if I write this or whatever? Like if I write a serial killer story, people are going to think I'm a serial killer and all this kind of thing. And we sometimes as writers get trapped by our own self-doubts and self-consciousness. Right. Now here you are. You're talking about this story in a way that's opening your heart to this woman sounded very easy. It sounded very natural. But to sort of turn around and tell that story, was there a fear of like, oh my God, what people might think and some of the responses you might get, or did you feel like the emotional journey you went on was more powerful than that?
I think I felt it was more powerful than worrying about it, because I'm also, you know, because I'm also coming from, you know, when I became an actor, I became really, I think, more vulnerable to the world and more like, you know what, I'm comfortable with bearing my soul. And so that's something I always forget now, because when people say they read it, they're like, I always forget. When I remember how open I was and honest and like flawed and everything just on the page, I still do get a little embarrassed. Like, now this person knows a lot more about me than I want. But yeah, I think the latter thing that you said is like, I feel like, it was such a moving experience in my life that I had to leave everything on the page. And if I wasn't 100% honest and 100% raw with it, then it wouldn't have, you know.
It wouldn't have been worth a damn. You know, you have to commit to a story like this, and you have to commit to the emotional honesty. Yeah, you're right, because otherwise people are going to be like, oh, well, this boy met a nice old lady, and they had a nice time, and isn't that nice?
Right,
when exactly. That's not really doing the story justice. So you released the memoir, and then, and you know, here on Amazon, the link is below, but it's 4.5 stars based on 164 customer reviews. So the book is pretty acclaimed. How did turning it into a play come about?
Last year, I'll tell you exactly when I knew I had to start writing the stage play. Last year around February or April, a friend forwarded me a link, and it showed that Helen Mirren was now attached to play Maria Altman in a new movie. There had been other movies in development, but this one looked good because it had the Weinsteins and BBC Films. So it's like two heavy hitters. And so when I saw that, I went through a range of emotions, thinking completely irrationally, like they were taking my story away from me. And now, you know, what am I going to do? And all this story I want to keep telling, I'm not going to. But then, you know, I realized that this is a great chance for me. And these are two totally different stories, because theirs is called Woman in Gold, and theirs is about how Maria got these paintings back from the Nazis. Whereas my story is sort of this Harold and Maude-esque love story. So I got right to work on the stage play, and I spent all summer writing it. And I also wrote the screenplay in tandem just to have. And then I thought to myself, I want to open it in New York. And at this point I had been in LA for 15 years, and I figured, okay, I'm just going to pack everything into my car and drive to New York with the script, and I'm going to put it up somehow. And I did. And, I put it up in January of this year.
What exactly do you mean by put it up? I'm not super familiar. Is that a theater term?
I didn't know. I submitted to a bunch of festivals, and every day I'm just contacting producers. I'm doing whatever I can. I don't know how it's going to go up, whether it's in a festival.
Copy.
So I ended up getting into this festival, and they run at this theater. It's a great location across from the Public Theater in the village. And so I got into the festival, and so we put it up. We put the play up for three performances in January, and so that was sort of just the beginnings of it. And we sold out every show, and I'm really proud of it. But you know, and then since then I've been trying to get it up somewhere else, and I would love to get it to Austria. And I just last week heard that the Austrian Cultural Forum invited me to do a stage reading of it. So that's pretty cool.
Nice. Yeah. Nice. Well, break a leg with that. Okay, so check it out. So you talk about how the Weinsteins, oh, they're going to take my story. But at the same time, let me ask you this. When you were casting the play, how hard was it to cast a new Maria?
Well, it was hard in that of course, you know, my standards were raised, and it was very hard. Okay. And technically it was hard because I had to keep the play non-equity. So to find a brilliant actress over the age of 70, who's non-equity,
right,
huge, was like, everyone's telling me like, you ain't gonna, they don't exist, you know? And so that was very daunting. And I thought, well, what if I never find a Maria, then I'm screwed. But we had this woman traipse through the audition one day, and she was 75 years old, and it was beautiful, beautiful white flowing hair. And she just said two words, and we were in love with her. She had this perfect German accent that wasn't too much. And so we ended up finding a Maria, and I was very happy with her. I told her, I said, you're Maria. And she was just, yeah.
So she did exist.
She did. I mean, look, there's, I mean, in an actor in front of us, yes. I mean, I can't say that there's never, I don't think I'll ever meet another Maria. She was just an incredibly unique woman. But what we had in front of us was someone who could definitely bring a lot of what Maria could offer onto the stage for people to see. Yeah.
Now, did you play yourself in the play, or was somebody else Gregor Collins?
No, somebody else. It was too much work. This is my first play I've ever put up as a producer, and so I'm like, I'm producing it, I'm writing it, I'm trying to. I mean, there was no way I could act in it. And also, I feel like I lived it in real life for 3 years, mm-hmm. so I really had no desire to reenact what I lived, again, you know.
So, okay, yeah, no, that makes total sense. And also, I imagine it's got to be tricky as taking a real-life experience that you personally have lived, because there's a certain distance that isn't there.
Exactly.
And did you have to sort of create that distance yourself, or did you just say, oh, to hell with it, we're going to, you know, or did you, you know, do you ever feel too close to the project at times?
Yes, which, and it helped that I had other outside eyes, like I, you know, the woman who directed it, I feel like we met for a reason. She's a UK director, and we met on Twitter actually, and she flew here on her own dime to direct it, and it was her first show in New York, and I feel like she, you know, having her, a brilliant young director, classically trained, who kind of connected to it the same as I did, and she had all these brilliant other things. So it made me feel like, okay, maybe I'm not crazy. Like, I have somebody else who sees what I see, you know?
No, you're not crazy. And, well, it's funny. You may have actually mentioned this a few answers ago, so forgive me if you're repeating yourself.
Sure.
Do you see this having a future as a screenplay or potentially a movie? A lot of plays are adapted these days.
Yeah, no, I absolutely do. And it needs to be further developed. But the thing that I can do in the movie that I can't do in the play is that I can, you know, the whole hook of my movie would be that when Grant and Gregor and Maria meet, it's as if, you know, they met another life. So it kind of flashes back to when Maria is escaping the Holocaust, and we actually find that her husband is actually me, but in another era, like dressed differently, a totally different person. And so throughout this present day Hollywood story, it flashes back to these things. So it's kind of like the Notebook kind of scenario, you know?
Yeah, but I think this might be, well, no offense to the Notebook,
right.
You know, but I think this might be a little bit deeper than that. But I'm not knocking it, because there's definitely a place for movies like the Notebook and the fun that offers. Yeah. Well, that sounds very cool. I hope you get this thing off the ground. Now, speaking of getting stuff off the ground, this is stuff that we're talking about. I mean, it's very interesting about your story, and I sort of preface this at the top of the show, is you are somebody, and I think there's a real lesson in what you're talking about, in the sense of, like, you had this experience, it came along, you opened your eyes, and you said you opened your heart to it, and then you let that experience sort of take you on this creative journey. Like, nobody booked you for this stuff. Nobody, no agent or manager was pushing you toward this stuff. Like, you really kind of took control of your own creative career and said, this is the story I'm going to tell.
Right.
What before this happened, what was your experience in the entertainment business life? Did you feel like you were being pushed and pulled in different directions? You and I have both have had to pay some bills from the trenches of reality TV producing. Like, were you kind of dissatisfied with the way things were going before all this went down?
Yes. I don't think my problem was I was being pushed and pulled in different directions. I think my problem was that things weren't happening quick enough. Like, I felt like,
sure,
I had the agent and I had a manager, but who, like, how could I ever just be comfortable with, like, going on, like, you go to an audition, sometimes you don't have an audition for a month, or sometimes nothing's happening. And so how can that, I don't know how that can be okay with some people. I just felt like I needed to keep working and keep expressing myself. And I just felt like, I mean, not that, like, you can have representation and still do things yourself, but it's just, I found that most of my representation, they wouldn't, like, everybody laments about, they don't do enough for you. And so I just felt like the time where I realized I needed to take my career into my own hands, and this was around the time when like crowdfunding just started up. And so we were one of the, like with one of this indie films we did, we were one of the first films to use crowdfunding back in like late 2008, early 2009. And it just felt, I feel like you have to, in order to get something going, you have to jump off the cliff before something is happening.
Yeah.
Like you can't have all your ducks in a row before you jump out of the plane with no parachute, you know? You have to just jump out, and then while you're free falling, that's when you kind of find something worth fighting for, you know?
I can't agree with what you just said enough. And it was one of the biggest lessons I learned. And it's a hard one. It's a hard lesson for a lot of people to wrap their heads around, I think, because it's scary to jump off that cliff. And yeah. In many ways you are. I mean, you're putting up financial risks. You're putting up free time risks and things like that. You know, in the creative world, it sounds kind of strange. I always have a hard time sort of defining this in that, like, it's not like 9 to 5, clock out, go home, turn off your brain, and then go to barbecues and stuff on the weekend. It just doesn't work that way. And that's scary to some people.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Yeah.
And,
you have to be kind of a salt of the earth person, and I think you just have to. Yeah, you're either the type of person that wants the normalcy and the sort of like they want to be, you know, always secure financially. And it, I mean, who doesn't want to be secure financially? But it's just like, yeah. I mean, yeah.
Well, there's also fears of failure. You know, there's fears of, oh my God, what if nobody likes it? What if everybody makes fun of me?
Right.
What if it's just not as good as I thought it was going to be? I think those are all definitely traps that people fall in. How do you deal with stuff like that? Or is it something that you don't really face a lot?
Well, I think it helps to, I think you first have to realize, to see if you really are good or talented. I mean, you have to get feedback. And I think what I always do when I write something, I mean, I always get feedback from some reliable friends, because I'm always so close to it. And so I think if you're getting good feedback from other unbiased, reliable people, then I think that should tell you that maybe I am doing the right thing, you know?
Mm-hmm. I also think there is an element of like, and I don't know if, you know, I think you probably went through this with accidental caregiver. An element of sort of, look, I kind of have to do this. You know what I mean? I feel like this was a story you were called to. And I know you have other things that you've worked on and we can absolutely talk about those too. But you almost sort of feel like I hate to use the word calling, but like, which is probably the best word for it. Right. But just almost like that feeling of like, I absolutely have to do this.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like I owed it to a lot of things. I feel like I owed part of it. The smaller part of it is that I owed it to history, because Maria is a public figure, and she was obviously is portrayed in this movie with Helen Mirren right now, Woman in Gold. And so I felt like she was telling me a lot of these anecdotes that you can't even really find in history books. And so I felt, and I also felt I owed it to being a caregiver, and I owed it to love, and I owed it to myself. And I just feel like I wanted to just leave this behind, both for me and for, I mean, it's not like she wanted me to write this book. I mean, she loved it. Like, I would show her, well, I was writing it while she was still around, and I would show her little pages, and she would get a kick out of it. But it's not like the family just wanted a caregiver. It's not like they were like, I mean, they support everything I do, but they're not saying, oh, please tell us, please keep telling the story about our mother. Sure. It's more like, we love you and we support you, and you know, we think you're representing our mother well, and so keep going, you know.
No, absolutely. So you were acting. So this all occurred to you while you were an actor, and you should have been doing more acting. When you really decided to pursue acting full time, was writing something you had sort of given up, or was it just sort of still in the side there? Were you like, well, or you were just totally concentrating on acting?
I was totally on acting. I've always been a writer, I think, but I just full on was acting, and then we did a couple indie films. One of them was called Goodbye Promise that I co-wrote and starred in, and that was and we improvised. We actually improvised the whole movie.
Wow.
Yeah.
But writing wasn't something that you could easily put down or give up, it sounds like.
No, because writing is just a, like, I think the same muscle I use. I feel like the better writer I am, the better actor I am. The better actor I am, the better writer I am. And I just think I, you know, it goes back to the whole, like, when you're writing, it's like, no, like, was it Robert Frost? Is like, no tears in the writer, no tears in the reader, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And obviously that's true for acting, too. So, you know, it's just like the same muscle.
Yeah, that's actually a topic that fascinates me a lot, because I think that sometimes writers and actors share the same insanity, if that makes sense.
Right,
and
yeah.
I think there's a lot that writers can learn from actors, specifically in the sense of the truth of the thing. You know what I mean? Like, I often hear actors talk about, well, I'm trying to get to the truth of this character.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't hear writers talking enough about, I'm trying to get to the truth of the story.
That's true. Yeah, that's a good point.
So,
yeah.
When you say you use the same muscle, is it the type of thing where, like, do you kind of wish you had gotten into acting, like, years ago, like, before you got into writing?
It's part of me says that. Part of me, part of me thinks, well, if I had gotten into acting, but I think if I had gotten into acting earlier, I don't know that I would have ever met Maria.
Oh, yeah, there you go. That sure.
All these things would have ever happened, and... So I think I'm on the journey I'm supposed to be on. I think we're all on the journey we're supposed to be on, and I feel like everyone we meet is for a reason. I mean, it's said so often, but I really feel like even our mistakes are meant to be those mistakes, you know?
No, absolutely. Looking at, say, actually, I'm thinking about that phrase you use, using the same muscle between acting and writing.
Mm-hmm.
What exactly do you mean by that?
I think when you approach acting or writing, it needs to come from the same place and then the deepest part of you place that it's this simple and it's the simplest part of you and it's the instinctual part of you. So I think your deepest instinct and whatever that is, I think that's what you need to use, and you know, I mean, you could. That's why writing. I mean, you know, as a writer, you can't just sit down and write. I mean, you have to, like, it's such a commitment, like,
yeah,
to really get deep and to really use that deepest instinct in you. You have to, like, you almost have to psych yourself into it. You
mm-hmm.
know, you can't just, like, happen to do it. That's why I mean, as an act, like, there are different types of. I guess there are different types of artists and different types of actors. Some actors can just, you know, like before a role, they don't need to prepare. They just go right into it. But, you know, I really need to get in the right headspace, you know?
No, I think there's definitely a zone that you have to get into.
Yeah.
Especially in the world of writing. It's almost trance-like.
Right.
And I know I've had the experience just millions of times where it's like, you know, if I'm somewhere writing and then I go back into the real world, it's almost like emerging from a pool.
Right, yeah.
You know, it's almost like you're still in a reality and you're still in the world, but it's just a different way of looking at it.
Right.
And a different way of seeing it. Now, you and I both fell in the same trap. You know, in the early 2000s, the industry was very much dominated by reality TV and unscripted TV. And it's still there and it will probably always be around, and that's great. I'm very grateful for what I've learned and the money I've made with reality TV, but I'm happy to sort of be putting it further in the rear view at the same time, because it wasn't really my calling. But I learned a lot during reality TV and I learned a lot of practical industry experience, so I'm not ungrateful.
Right.
How did reality TV either help or hinder you in your current experiences?
Well, first of all, my first job was in reality. So, like, all my good friends I know today are some way connected to my time in reality. So I made a lot of great friends. I made a lot of great connections, and I learned how story is done. I mean, because even in unscripted TV, you know, it's largely written. I mean, you have to produce it. You have to tell a story with nothing, you know? So I feel like I'm a better storyteller, and I feel like I've seen a more comprehensive view of how a set works. And I kind of, before I became an actor, I knew how things worked. I knew what this guy on set did and what, you know, so a lot of actors come in and they don't know anything about anything other than just acting. So I feel like, I feel like those things, I don't feel like it, I don't regret it, or like you, I don't regret it in any way. I don't think poorly upon it. Most actors, they have disdain for reality TV because it's, I guess, taking away acting jobs for them or whatever. But,
Well, it's a part of the bit. I know for a while there, it really did torpedo scripted drama in the early 2000s, but
yeah,
scripted drama has recovered pretty nicely.
Right.
So they've been okay.
So, I mean, how is it, how for you as a writer, has it, your background in reality, has that helped you with your screenwriting or your writing or what?
Where it's helped me, I can tell you, is knowing TV structure, like writing TV pilots. Mm-hmm. I did not have to learn structure at all. It was right there. Just instinctive. And you almost know, and that's one of the great things I learned was you almost, I'd be writing, let's say, act two, and I'm like, I'm coming to the end. And I didn't even have to check the pages. You could almost feel it. Mm-hmm. And there is, you know, you talked a bit about instinctual stuff. And I think some of that stuff can actually be learned just by doing it numerous times. So that certainly helped out. And yeah, the other thing too, that I think it always goes back to writing. And we talked about this on my episode with Rory LaPointe, was that the thing that reality or scripted and unscripted have in common is that when you approach a scene, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, no matter what genre, no matter what you're writing, the scene will always be driven by the goals and motivations of the characters.
Right.
And if you don't have a handle on those, you're going to be lost.
Yeah, I agree.
If you do, you're rock and roll.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. Yeah, and every, you know, everything has to have a beginning, middle, and end, and you have to, a clear motivation from the character. Yeah, I agree. When you write, are you, would you say you're more, you're story driven, character driven? What is your main style of telling a story?
I write character driven dramas.
Yeah.
I really am curious. A lot of times it does come from a concept first. I'll usually think of a concept like, oh, that's cool. That's a cool premise. Right. But then who do I want to see within that premise? Who's going to be the perfect person? Right. Or not perfect, I hate to say it like that, but who's going to be a very interesting character to throw into that idea? I like the idea of your story, the accidental caregiver idea. It was a real life experience.
Yeah.
But the idea of taking these two generations and bringing them together in unlikely circumstances, and what each other can learn from the thing, and the different perspectives that they bring to each other. It's a fascinating world. That's a fascinating story to tell.
Yeah.
Fiction or not. And so, yeah, so I learned that from reality, you know, and that's usually what, you know, sometimes people are like, how could you have worked on that stuff? And it's quite easy.
And it's very, it takes some skill. You know, I mean, it was just interviewing, I write articles for Cinema Editor magazine, and I was just interviewing the editor of the Anthony Bourdain Parts Unknown. And I mean, it's...
What a show.
Oh, I love that. I mean, I just started really watching it, and it's just... I mean, it's genius because every episode is in a different city, so you could never get bored, you know?
And the precursor to that, No Reservations, is he did an episode of No Reservations in Haiti.
Yeah.
That I would argue is maybe the finest 1 hour of unscripted TV ever done. And again, kind of tying back to what we were talking about, and they showed Bourdain crying in the streets. You know, he's walking through Haiti. This is post-earthquake. I think it's a year or two after the earthquake hit, maybe even 3 years. It was a while. Sean Penn was still there.
Wow.
And everything. And Bourdain is walking around going, where am I? What happened to this place? Why is no, you know, and it was he very much did not hide any of his emotional response to seeing this land shattered by this terrible tragedy.
Wow. And you don't often see Bourdain get emotional.
No, he's too busy being a smartass sometimes.
Yeah.
But when he confronts it, he's, you know, and you see him, he's made a real archive, I think, of the world around us.
Right.
All that kind of thing. That what kind of stuff, I mean, is this the type of thing where, here's a question about accidental caregiver again. Had you not experienced this, is this a story you would have written?
No, absolutely not. I mean, if I had never met Maria, no. I mean, I never had a plan to write a book. I mean, that wasn't something I wanted to check off any bucket lists. I would have written a book at some point. I don't know, but it definitely wasn't in the cards and wasn't on my mind. And because I had met this woman is the only reason I had written a book, you know? I feel like I would have attracted maybe some kind of situation. Cause I guess I am an old soul,
mm-hmm.
and I do feel like ever since Maria, I do feel like I'm attracting older people, older women. It's like, I mean, and when I say older, I mean like 80s and 90s, you know, it's kind of weird.
Well, you have an honest face.
I guess. Yeah. I've always been pretty honest and trustworthy. Like people seem to trust me. And, I just hate being around people that are manipulative and people mm-hmm. that are smiling and thinking something else and passive aggression and people who aren't what they're saying they are. Like that to me makes me like feel so icky. Like I've never been impelled to be manipulative, you know?
Well, I don't have an argument to sell you on getting around those people. So
I know. And I meet a lot of those people in Los Angeles, and in New York, it feels like people are a little more real and honest and upfront. And in LA, you seem to meet a little more passive aggression.
It can be tricky. Yeah, it's definitely different. And I'm originally from New Jersey, and I probably got more relaxes and calm downs my first 3 years in LA more than ever in my life, because I'm like, I am calm. And it's like, oh wait, I'm from New Jersey. You guys.
Yeah.
Like I would be saying things in what I felt was a very normal tone, and people would be like, why are you freaking out? I'm like, what?
Right.
I'm not. I was just,
let's go surfing. Everything's all laid back out there.
It's sometimes, and you know, something I have sort of acclimatized to that. Truth be told, I think some people might be surprised how mellow I've become. But don't worry, the old Tim Davis is still there for old friends who are listening. You talked about how Maria being in the sunset of her life kind of didn't really care. That's not the right phrase. Maria in the sunset of her life was just going to say what was on her mind. You know, she's been there, done that. So she's not going to put on a lot of pretenses. If she has something she wants to say, she's going to say it. Is that, it sounds like that's something that's very much up your speed, up your alley. And like, yes, just please, just tell me what you're thinking. And I think that is a little bit more a New York kind of tri-state area type of attitude. Right.
Well, she would say, but she had a very, just an elegance and a grace and a charm about, I mean, you know, when I described, she would say what's on her mind. It was sort of like Mary Poppins saying what's on her mind, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So there was such an elegance about her, and she did towards the end, you know, she had developed a little bit of, you know, dementia. And so she kind of, it's like she was living in that world of being, I think when you have dementia, you're totally in the present. And you're not, you know, you're not living in the past or the future. You're just like totally enjoying the moment. And that even helped her more enjoy the moment. And I felt like her charm and her sharpness and her cleverness kind of overpowered the dementia. I mean, it was incredible how she fought it with, and she was lucky because I think one of the things when you have Alzheimer's and dementia, one of the things that even doctors admit to is that really the only thing you can do to combat it is just to keep your mind stimulated, constantly stimulated. And so Maria was lucky enough to be able to afford to have people, like really smart young people around her that could keep her young, you know?
Yeah.
Mind wow. active.
That's wild.
Yeah. What was the original thing you're talking about, her being honest and, or being...
Yeah, I mean, sometimes people in their golden years, you know,
yeah,
they're not going to pretend.
Right, and she would, And I knew she would, when she told me, like, I wish I met you 70 years ago, like, she would really mean that. And mm-hmm. And she would say, like, heartbreaking things to me. Like, she would say, and this went right into my script. She said to me, once we were drinking a glass of wine in the den, and she was like, you know, people today don't say, they say I love you like they're saying hello. They don't even really mean it anymore. And then there was a pause, and then she looked at me and she goes, I love you. Wow. And that really, really hit me hard. I mean, it gives me chills to this day, because it was just so perfectly timed and it was just so heartfelt, you know?
Wow. Yeah. Wow. I don't even know what to say to that.
Yeah.
That's great. That's true.
Yeah.
Let's talk, Goodbye Promise is also sounds quite a bit autobiographical.
Yeah, it is. Everything I do, I can't get away from my life. It's like everything, and maybe it's self. I can't think of the being wrapped up in my. Maybe it's I can't even think of the word. But yeah, everything seems to be autobiographical.
I think most writing is autobiographical, no matter what, no matter how hard we try. We always end up just writing something about ourselves. And even if it's not always true. Like I said, I don't think, you know, I'm trying to develop a story right now about gay serial killers. I am neither gay nor a serial killer, but I'm sure there will be some interesting things about myself that come out, you know, psychologically, whether it be, you know, whatever sort of, I don't know. We'll find out. Who knows?
Right.
But you seem to be embracing it a bit more consciously of saying, you know, I'm going through these things and there's story in here, so let me explore that.
Yeah. I just feel like anything creative I do is always based around the struggles that I have in my life, are always more can I do? How can I love more? How can I be a better person? How can I not wake up and feel completely lost? And how do I find meaning in my life? And how do I, you know, like these constant things of how do I find more meaning in things? And I don't know. It's just like, I feel like every day I struggle with that stuff. And so every character I write is kind of also struggling to find the real meaning of love and to what it means to really love. And, you know, that's why I kind of like reading, you know, I'll read like Oscar Wilde is someone that I love, always love to read. Cause it seems like he sort of had those struggles too.
Well, I think everybody has those struggles.
Yeah.
But
not that I'm alone. Yeah.
Oh no. I'm not saying, but I think though, what you're doing, that's a good example. And to, I know a fair amount of my listeners are people who are aspiring, to do screenwriting and get in the entertainment business. I think there's a real lesson there as well, in the sense of like, if you're sad, lonely, depressed, and struggling, I'm saying that with a chuckle, but I'm not really laughing. You're far from alone, and that's where a lot of stories come from.
From pain.
It's, and a lot of times when you see think of your favorite author, and you're like, my God, how did they know that? It's like they were talking to me. They weren't talking to you. They're going through it too. And that's what they're exploring. And that's how you're able to relate.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. It's in a way a kind of a dark blessing about going through depression or whatever you want to call it, because, that's when you really, that's when you have things to write about and things to tell, you know?
Well, it's funny, when I started this whole podcast venture, I thought, because sometimes I'm not always very big on people who are like, hey, here's your, write a screenplay in whatever weeks and do these particular steps and you'll have yourself a movie. I'm not always big on that instruction. I wanted to start this podcast in the sense of like, well, let me get a bunch of people I know in the industry and let's talk about the nuts and bolts of how we do creative things.
Right.
As opposed to some sort of instruction manual. This is just almost like a giant industry memoir.
Right.
But it has turned out to be, in many episodes, explorations of things like depression and self-doubt and insecurities and all these things that that we constantly struggle with. You know, I'm writing two independent movies right now, but, you know, if I get a rejection letter from a prospective manager, that still sucks, you know? Still, you still are sitting there going, oh my God, does this story not work? Should I think of something else? Should I blah, blah, blah? No matter what, you go through it.
Yeah. You never get, yeah, it's just, there's so much rejection in this business. It's just, I mean, how many no's do you, I mean, it's like, man, yeah, it's but that's the cool thing about when the rejection in this business, the cool part about it is that you actually, you know, you don't have to be rejected as much as you think, because you just kind of take things in your own hands use social media and use whatever free tools are out there. And if you have really good content, then you don't have to be rejected. You just take it right to the audience, you know?
That's such a great point, and it's true, because a lot of times the rejection isn't actually a personal rejection. If I'm a comedy producer, right, Gregor? If I write zany comedy, or I produce zany comedies like Let's Be Cops and the Hangover Trilogy, mm-hmm. and you walk into my office with The Accidental Caregiver, I'm not buying your story. You know what I mean? I'm not going to buy it. I'm going to be like, well, where is the zany fun stuff?
Right. Exactly.
So if I say no to Accidental Caregiver, that is not really a rejection of your story. It's more of actually it's not a right fit. You've got to find the right fit. And that's the challenge of the entertainment business, I think.
Right. Finding that person, finding that everybody wants to, like me, I mean, I want to find this champion or someone to, with, you know, everybody, no matter how indie you are and how independent you are, you want to find that person with power and money mm-hmm. to help you make it bigger. And so that's, you know, I'm looking for this, constantly looking for these champions, you know?
Absolutely. And you know something? You may make 50 movies and write 10 more memoirs, and we may have the conversation after that, and you may say the same thing. I'm still looking for my champions.
Right. Well, it never stops. That's the thing. No matter how much success you achieve, in this business, I feel like you meet a lot of old time, really successful people that will tell you that, listen, I after every job, I thought I would never work again or something, you know, but they somehow, I think, you know, Humphrey Bogart would say that famously, is that he thought he would never work again after every movie. And so that's just the nature of the business.
Absolutely. It's a great point. You have to sort of embrace that a little bit, I think. And a lot of people, it's hard. It's, again, we're going back to what we were talking about before, that, you know, I hate to say it takes a certain type of person, quote unquote, but it is a certain type of life, and it is a certain type of thing that you almost have to embrace some of that stuff is also very counterintuitive. Mm-hmm. You have to sort of embrace, those feeling and fears of failure.
Yeah.
You know, and it's a point there about agents and managers. A lot of them want to get onto a fast moving train. They want to get into an already moving train.
Right.
A lot of them don't want to discover anybody. They want to, you know. So what's? I'm sorry.
No. Yeah. Well, that's frustrating for a lot of actors. Yeah.
Yeah, but at the same time, I think the answer is to kind of do what you're doing. Which is, hey, you know something? Hell with it. I'm going to do this anyway. I'm going to do it without you guys. And
you have to have that inner drive and you may not know what story you want to tell or what it's going to be that you're going to give to the world or whatever. But I think if you just have that inner fire and drive to just that self-starting kind of drive to just express yourself and give to the world something back that you think other people can be inspired by, then I think you'll eventually find that if you have that fire. But a lot of people seem to just, you know, want to get that, you know, be a writer who just writes something and emails it to his agent and then makes millions of dollars, or like they just have this image of like going on a talk show and talking about their success, but they're not willing to like do the work to get it, you know.
No, absolutely. And it is, you know, sometimes you can't go to the bar on a Friday night, you know, sometimes you stay home and write or go to the barbecue or something like that. Let me, your comment though, just spawned another question if I can, which is like, when you, I mean, looking at Goodbye Promise and Accidental Caregiver, you know, this is autobiographical, but at the same time, this is some pretty heavy stuff. You know, you're tackling some real heavy emotional things that are kind of hard to wrap your head around, I think. Did you actually know what the pieces were going to be like before you set out to make them? Or were you just sort of like, you know something, I'm just going to dive in and see what happens?
You mean with the book or the film?
The book, the film, any of it. You know what I mean?
With Goodbye Promise, we just had an outline and we said, okay, we want to tell a story where an actor gives himself 7 years to become a movie star, and the movie opens up a week before his self-prescribed deadline, and no one, he's still anonymous, no one knows who he is, and so he's going to quit the business. And so he just has a few people to talk to before he just quits forever and leaves his dreams. So we just felt like there's always movies about keeping the dream alive, and you can do it and you can do it. And we just wanted to tell a movie about an honest movie about failure. And it's, but it's uplifting too. Like I knew, like, I guess it's part, you know, no struggling artist wants to go see a movie about failure because it would just make them more depressed. So it does have a level of optimism to it, because he sort of discovers towards the end, his view of success is different, and he just sort of feels like he's getting closer to happiness, you know, or his self or whatever meaning in his life that he needs. So,
but now, was that stuff you like discovered during the making of the movie?
Exactly. Yeah. That's, I mean, we just had laid out, we said, okay, he's going to meet his one friend who is like his mentor, and he's going to meet a female friend who quit acting to be a mother. He's going to meet a guy who smokes weed all day, and he's talented, but he's wasted. So like we had all these personalities that he's going to meet, and that's it. So we would go and we would meet the first person, and then we would just turn on the camera, and we only had one camera. And so we would do one take of me, and then turn the camera around, do a take of them, and then that's it. Whatever came out of it came out of it. And so we found that this narrative was forming. And then I'm really proud of the ending of the movie, because like the ending, he had a going away party, and like we just shot it, and it was just like we didn't even know if he was going to leave Hollywood or stay. Like it was just like, and then there was a fire. Like while we were filming, there was an actual fire in 2009 in the Sunland area. There was like a huge forest fire, and so we ended up shooting that. Like it was literally like 1,000 yards from the house we were shooting at. So like we shot out the windows, and like Los Angeles was on fire, and so we incorporated that into the story. It was like kind of nice, like. Everybody would say like, oh yeah, you're going out in flames, aren't you? You know, that kind of thing.
Oh, wow. Well, again, you're taking a real life experience, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So.
And incorporating it.
It's hard to turn the mirror on yourself. So it was very hard shooting it because, you know, we were talking about struggles that we were going through. I mean, it's hard. It's really hard to face your problems. And most people in their life, some people in their lifetimes never do. They're too scared of it.
Well, I was going to say, it sounds like you almost couldn't do it any other way.
Right.
Exactly. You know what I mean? Like if I wanted to hire you to write some sort of, you know, banal, fun little runaround farce, I'm not sure. You know what I mean? Is that something you could probably do it, but would you really enjoy doing it?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, you mean as an, like I,
as a writer, you know what I mean?
Yeah, like, as a writer, I actually am pretty, you know, I can, yeah, well, it depends, because I just wrote a couple 10-minute plays that were very, very farcical, and I had fun with them and everything. And it's nice because it gets so tedious to always be writing this dramatic stuff. So I just wanted like a break, and so it's a pretty, pretty crazy premise, but it was fun. So, but yeah, I mean. If there was a big, if it was a producer with money who wanted to hire someone to write a farce, they wouldn't go to me because I don't have any credits with that stuff. So,
well, not yet, at least.
Yeah, exactly.
Or as one of my favorite authors said, Terrence Dix, he often said, "No matter what you get hired for, your first response to whatever the premise should be, that's always been a secret hobby of mine, and a secret passion of mine." Be like, "Yes, of course, I'm interested."
Right.
So we talk about agents and managers are looking for an already fast-moving train. What's next on the Gregor Collins fast-moving train?
Well, I have a reading next, the end of June, at the Austrian Cultural Forum with the Accidental Caregiver, and I've had to cut the play we performed in January. We had it was an hour and a half, and it was 9 in the cast, and I've had to cut this down to 45 minutes with a cast of 2 for this. But it's a good exercise, and this is a really good step for the play, because then this is like a really legitimate kind of, you know, a next step, like almost like the Austrian press to legitimize the story, to potentially bring it to Austria next. So that'll be great. So that's next. And then I would love this year, my plan is to get the movie in development somehow. And then my two goals are get the movie in development and then perform it again, whether it be in Austria or somewhere else. And then I also just wrote a new play, a totally different new play that I'd love to continue to develop. And yeah, beyond that, I have no freaking clue.
And isn't that the exciting part?
It's exciting and scary, but probably for me, it's probably like 75% exciting, 25% scared shitless, you know.
That's a great ratio. You're beating me on some days. So
well, believe me, that's what I feel like today, but I can wake up tomorrow and it could be like 30% exciting and 70, you know.
Oh, I hear you, man. I hear you. That's the thing. So, well, listen, this is a great story that brings both a historical importance but also a personal emotion. And whenever you can combine those two, you know, well done. The name of the book is The Accidental Caregiver: How I Met, Loved, and Lost Legendary Holocaust Refugee Maria Altman. It's available on Kindle for $9.99. It's also available on paperback for a few bucks more. And sometimes there's promotions for the Kindle and things of that nature. We're also going to put links below for your IMDb and Goodbye Promise and stuff. Gregor Collins, you're doing great work, and you're setting a real example to a lot of us writers, no matter what level you're at, to, you know something, when you're faced with something emotionally powerful, grab hold of it, and that's only going to help you tell your story, no matter how difficult it seems at the time.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you, Tim. I'm really glad we found each other, and hey, I hope to work with you one day.
Absolutely. I can't wait to see The Accidental Caregiver on the big screen. I will be there front and center. So, absolutely. Well, we'll keep the conversation going. We got plenty more exciting guests from the world of all manners of entertainment coming up over the next few weeks here in springtime. Gregor Collins, can't thank you enough for taking the hour to come on the Hansitimity Express.
Thank you very much.
And thanks, everybody, for listening, and we will see you soon. This is Tim Davis on the HTD Express.